Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. For pregnant women reaching that final month, one of the most common questions they're likely to ask is,
how will I know when I'm in labor? When will it start? What will it feel like? Well, at least those were the questions I was asking my doctor when I had my daughter last year. Because even though doctors can estimate a due date, honestly, it's a bit of a vague science, and no one really knows the exact day a baby will come.
Except for those women who choose the day their babies will be born. These are women who pick a day in advance, and when that day comes, even if labor has not yet started, they go to the hospital and have labor induced or give birth via C-section.
Now, there are many serious medical reasons to induced labor. But cases where no medical reason exists, those are called elective deliveries, and most are done right around what should be the natural end of pregnancy at 39 or 40 weeks into gestation.
But what happens when delivery is induced a couple of weeks before that? That is called elective early delivery, and studies show that in the U.S., approximately 15% of babies are born this way, and the numbers are rising.
That hasn't always been the case, says Dr. Glenn Markinson, the director of maternal and fetal medicine at Bay State Medical Center in Springfield.
Before the benefit of the neonatal intensive care unit, people were very, very conservative and would not induce or do C-sections before 39 weeks. But as they saw how well babies were doing with the pediatric care and they were getting pressured by patients because of social situations, there was a creep down from 39 weeks to 38 weeks, maybe even sometimes 37 weeks.
But now a new group of studies are showing that babies born through early elective deliveries have more than twice the number of complications compared to those born at 39 or 40 weeks.
And as a result, several Massachusetts hospitals have banned elective early deliveries.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about why that is and what's driving this move. And joining us now is Dr. Toni Golan. She's a practicing obstetrician at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. That is one of the Massachusetts hospitals that has banned this early elective delivery procedure. Dr. Golan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So I wonder first if you could just walk us through the new findings about why exactly it is that having a baby born before 39 or 40 weeks, it turns out to be not so great for their health.
Well, over the last several years, there have been some very well-designed studies that have really shown us that babies do differently at 39 weeks than they do at 37 weeks. For example, a baby born at 37 weeks is twice as likely to have respiratory difficulties, require extra oxygen, or be admitted to the neonatal intensive care unit.
And so, therefore, I mean, and in fact, from what I understand, the number of complications or the severity of complications kind of goes up more dramatically than we had thought with each week that the baby is born earlier.
That is absolutely true. So every week that we can get beyond 37 weeks, we get advantages for the baby, and babies do well. They do better after 39 weeks than they do after 37 weeks.
Okay. And so if you can talk to me a little bit about some of the actual organ systems, I mean, that are still developing in the final weeks of pregnancy, because I think it's sort of commonly thought that most of the development of the fetus is done by that time and babies are just putting on weight in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think that's what many people believe, and that's based on a lot of women's experiences. So lots of women have delivered spontaneously at 37 or 38 weeks, and their babies do very, very well. But we do know that when we intervene, or even sometimes when labor happens on its own at 37 weeks, those babies' respiratory systems, lungs are not completely developed. Their feeding mechanisms are not completely developed. So they may not have as good a time or as easy a time latching onto for breastfeeding. They may not be able to absorb their nutrition as well. Their glucose in their body, the levels of glucose may not be as good. We've also found that there may, in fact, be some longer-term neurodevelopmental deficits that may arise when babies are born earlier.
Hmm. Now, given all that, I guess it kind of raises the question as to why early elective delivery for non-medical reasons was ever even introduced as a practice in hospitals.
I think that it arose because, well, as Dr. Markinson had said earlier, we've become a little bit spoiled. Our neonatal intensive care colleagues have become experts at making babies well, and babies, by and large, do pretty well after 37 weeks. However, you know, there's been a little bit of a slide in the direction of patients as well as obstetricians feeling like it might be just okay to intervene. It's complicated when a woman is having a baby and all the things that she needs to juggle, and the obstetrician becomes a real partner with the patient and her family in trying to resolve some of those child care issues that she might be juggling with, or thinking about school enrollment deadlines, or things that have to do with buying plane tickets and families coming from far away. There are a lot of things, and it becomes complicated, and it's often difficult for the obstetrician or the midwife to juggle those things together with the patient and come to a decision that's the safest for the baby. It may seem like it's actually more convenient or more reasonable, or even based on the patient's previous experience, okay to have an early delivery.
So let me ask you about that, because just upon hearing what you're saying, I mean, I imagine some people out there are thinking, why would any case of convenience trump the health of the child? But on the other hand, from what I understand, this sort of new group of studies has only recently emerged that sort of takes a look, you know, broadly across thousands of births that are happening early here, and that for any one obstetrician, maybe the incidences of complications from these elective early deliveries is actually quite low.
You're exactly right. And even more to the point, from the point of view of a patient, what the patient knows is a very, very small number of deliveries. Sure, the patient has lots of friends who have delivered babies, and some of them have had deliveries at 37 or 38 weeks. And also, as you point out, from the obstetrician standpoint, the number of deliveries that they've seen or babies that have done poorly at 37 or 38 weeks is probably small. But when you look at the real evidence, the real scientific data, and that looks at prospectively women who have been studied, who have undergone deliveries, tens of thousands of deliveries, we do know that the risk of complications is higher. And I think that the burden is on us as care providers to educate patients about what those risks are, because they may not realize what the risks are for their babies and their families when they're making that choice.
Mm. Now, you're a physician at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. That's one of the hospitals in Massachusetts that has recently decided to just not offer these elective early deliveries anymore. When did the hospital opt to take that sort of hard stop? Hard stop take on banning the procedure, essentially?
Late in 2008, we started to discuss it within our department. And then in early 2009, there was a very large study that came out that was very, very compelling. And as a department, we decided that we would put into place a process that would not allow physicians or midwives to book deliveries prior to 39 weeks if there was not a medical indication. And we created a scheduling process that really makes this fairly seamless. We have a skilled, experienced nurse who does our scheduling for us, and she's able to actually understand what the indications for delivery are. And then if there's any question, we have a system for resolving conflicts, and then ultimately a hard stop when a care provider wants to book a delivery prior to 39 weeks and we don't have the actual evidence for the medical indication to back it up.
Hmm. Well, listeners, we are talking about the rush to give birth and the growing numbers of women who are choosing what's known as elective early delivery, and now what seems to be a counter trend in several Massachusetts hospitals to actually ban the procedure. So what do you make of it? I mean, if you're a woman who did opt for an early delivery for non-medical reasons, why did you do so? And given the health concerns with delivering babies before they're due that we're hearing Dr. Golan speak about, should the practice be banned? Or would such a ban rob women of an essential choice at the end of their pregnancy? And also, I guess I'm wondering, for doctors who've done this procedure, why and what do you tell patients when they ask you for it? And what's really going on here? I mean, what does it say about medicine and our attitudes about medical care that we are even in a world where early delivery is an option? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Golan, if you could just stand by for a moment, I'd like to introduce another guest into the conversation. Her name is Jennifer Block, and she is author of Pushed: The Painful Truth About Childbirth and Modern Maternity Care. She's former editor of Ms. Magazine and an editor of the revised edition of Our Bodies Ourselves. She joins us today from Tucson, Arizona. Jennifer Block, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So what do you think about this, about first of all, the fact that it seems that the number of elective early deliveries has been going up yearly in the United States.
Yeah. I want to point out that definitely women are under pressures from work. They don't get a lot of maternity leave. They're trying to, you know, coordinate support from family. Their mother-in-law is flying in at a certain time. And, of course, there are families who are going to find it beneficial maybe to try to schedule a birth. But, you know, there's really no evidence that this is a trend that women are responsible for. And there's certainly a lot of evidence that there have been trends in medicine that have been promoting early induction and scheduling cesareans early. For instance, women who've had previous cesareans, they find it very difficult to have a vaginal birth after cesarean. In fact, many hospitals have banned that, which we can talk about in the context of women's choices. And so physicians often will want to schedule that repeat cesarean early so that labor isn't even an issue. And so a lot of that 15% of early deliveries is due to this trend of banning VBAC.
Mm. You know, I take your point, and I want to actually discuss with both you and Dr. Golan a little bit more about sort of how doctors approach this whole thing. But I read, for example, a couple surveys. One was from a group called Childbirth Connection. This is several years old, I'll grant. But they asked mm-hmm. people what medical and non-medical reasons for early induction of labor. And of those reasons, the top four were caregiver concerns that the woman was, quote, overdue. That was 25% of inductions. Maternal health problems requiring induction, 19%. But the number three one was mother's desire to get the pregnancy over with at 19%, almost 20%. So for a doctor, for example, who, you know, as we've heard, whose patient comes in and says, I have to be back at work at a certain day, which means I'm only going to have maybe, you know, 6-7 weeks of maternity leave if I'm lucky. If it's okay for the baby, why don't I just do this early? I mean, this seems like that is a source of pressure on physicians.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really, just like Dr. Golan said, it's really about patient education. Women listen to their doctors. We have a lot of respect for medical authority in this culture. And if women are told, yeah, you know, you are really uncomfortable and I'm free next Tuesday, let's just schedule it, and they don't hear any of the downsides, mm-hmm. of course they're going to, you know, I haven't been pregnant yet, but I can imagine that nearing 9 months, you're pretty uncomfortable. And, you know, anyone who has an escape hatch, you'll take it. So, you know, it's really about patient education. On the other hand, if women hear, you know what, I know you're really uncomfortable, but we know that the best thing for your baby is to be in there as long as it needs to and to give us the signal that it's ready to come out. And that's really what the research is showing, that babies give the signal when they're ready. That's mm-hmm. that's why labor starts. It's really the baby's lungs being mature.
Let me ask Dr. Golan about that, about this issue about patient education. You've mentioned it as well. I read a 2008 national survey of women that just asked them, you know, these are average women, when do you think a pregnancy has reached full term? And 51% said between 34 and 36 weeks of gestation, basically 9 months, because that's, you know, what we're all told. Pregnancy is 9 months. And then some 40% chose 37 to 38 weeks. So essentially an overwhelming majority of women go into a doctor's office thinking that full term is actually full term is shorter than what it really is.
Yes, I think that there's several different reasons why that has become the belief. And a lot of it, as we were talking about earlier, has to do with how advanced our neonatal intensive care has become. But as obstetricians, I think that some obstetricians may also become a little bit more casual about what it might mean to have a baby, say, at 35 or 36 weeks. And again, I agree with Ms. Block that the burden is on the caregiver, the midwife or the obstetrician, to educate the patient that 34, 35, or 36 weeks is not full term, and that these babies, although you might know a baby who was born at 35 or 36 weeks who did absolutely perfectly well, that in no way predicts that your baby is going to do that well. And if we look at this on a population base, in other words, across many tens and hundreds of thousands of deliveries, these babies who are born earlier simply do not do as well, and they may have long-term deficits because of it.
Dr. Golan, what about what Jennifer Block said about, for example, the what seems to be an unwillingness amongst obstetricians to allow women to try vaginal delivery after having C-section, and therefore, if you know you're going to have another C-section, you might as well just schedule it?
It's unfortunate that there are particular areas of the country where, because of resources and because of certain opinions about vaginal birth after cesarean, that it hasn't been and is not offered. In Boston, we're fortunate enough that we do have those resources, and we do encourage appropriate women and their families to consider having a vaginal birth after cesarean. I'll also agree that it's possible that delaying a C-section or waiting until the appropriate time for a C-section after 39 weeks, if a previous C-section is the only reason that she's having it, may actually allow that patient, that woman, to go through a trial of labor and have a vaginal birth after cesarean.
Mm. Jennifer Block, I know that you've written quite a bit about just the whole industry of labor, delivery, and being born. I mean, is your fundamental concern here that this is just another outcropping of the sort of consumerization of pregnancy?
Well, it's certainly the over-medicalization of pregnancy. You know, another reason for this trend is that our approach to birth has just become very technological, very interventive. And, you know, a recent survey of physicians actually showed that younger physicians are more fearful of childbirth, more willing to move to a cesarean and induce labor than their older peers. So we're just becoming more and more interventive. And, you know, medical liability concerns play into this because physicians are very concerned about a lawsuit. And so, you know, one reason I hear a lot of women are told to induce is that they're overdue.
They're told to induce, or when they suggest it, they're not told that they shouldn't do it? You see what I'm saying? Because I feel like this is a meeting of between a doctor and a patient. I mean, I guess I'll be clear here. I went through this. I had a little baby girl last year, and beforehand, you know, my doctor didn't say you should induce. She just sort of casually asked me, you know, what my plans were for the birth, and you know, where was I having family fly in, maternity leave, etc. And I was like, oh, I actually have a great situation, not a problem. And she said, okay, good, because I just have to check, because some people say they've got very limited sort of set of circumstances they have to deal with. She didn't say, I'm glad, because when women tell me that they need to have their labor early, that I don't say no. Do you see what I'm saying? So there's this critical conversation that happens between a doctor and a patient, and maybe that's where the drawback is. That's where the failing is, that the conversation isn't happening in full.
Absolutely. You know, the reason I titled my book Pushed was because I was hearing from so many women who felt like they were being pressured to induce or to move straight to a cesarean, or women who you know, went into labor naturally, got to the hospital, but then were sped up. They were you know, told, you're not going fast enough. We need to give you Pitocin and make your contractions stronger and essentially, you know, induce labor stronger. So, you know, I think from my, you know, the research I did, the women I talked to, most of them, it came from their physician. And some of them really, I mean, women told me they felt like their doctor started coming down on them. And I think that's a function of, you know, physicians are under a huge amount of malpractice pressure.
Let me get some calls in here, actually, yeah. if you don't mind, because we've got a lot of people who want to join us. Sarah is calling from Lexington. You're on the air, Sarah.
Hi. My question is, just in looking at the research and analyzing the results, what is the degree of accuracy around the gestation at the time of birth?
That's a great question, Sarah. Dr. Golan?
Well, historically, estimating the gestational age has been completely prone to error. So there's several different ways that we can calculate it. And at this point, in academic areas, so in Boston, in major cities, or places where patients have access to early ultrasound, dating of pregnancy is extremely accurate. So it's within about 5 days is what the error is. But oftentimes, that's not the case. And in many places in this country, that is not the case. And sometimes the estimate can be off as much as 2 weeks, which is a lot of the reason why the 39 weeks is a key number, because if 37 weeks were chosen as the date to have the baby actually might not be 37 weeks. The baby might be 35 weeks.
Let's take another call. Beth Ann is calling from Salem. You're on the air, Beth Ann.
Hi. I'm calling. I was induced 3 times with my 3 kids, and I'm a professional in Boston. I'm a professor, and I was lucky enough to be able to sort of time my pregnancies. And I think one thing that maybe gets overlooked in this is that the U.S. system for, you know, of maternity time and, you know, we don't support husbands in staying at home. And so that's a real problem, and it's a reality for a lot of women. And so while it might be not be ideal to be induced, it's almost a kind of professional necessity for a lot of women.
Beth Ann, thank you so much for your call. Jennifer Block, your response to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're offering medical solutions to social problems here. Mm-hmm. You know, women do not have enough support. They, you know, I talk to women who get 3 weeks off total. And so, you know, they want to work right up until they go into labor. So, you know, but scheduling it, of course, that would make it easier. And then we could plan exactly which 3 weeks you get off.
If I could, I want to, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Jennifer, but I want to spend the last couple minutes, we're down to just about 2.5 minutes here, to talk about what's practically being done on the ground here in Massachusetts. I mean, there are other states where, for example, in Utah, several hospitals band together and decided to offer this quote-unquote hard stop on elective early deliveries, and it actually had quite a profound effect. Not only did the number of elective early deliveries go down, but the number of children ending up in the neonative intensive care unit also dramatically went down. There's a meeting going on today here in Massachusetts sort of discussing this whole issue amongst obstetricians and the Department of Public Health. Dr. Golan, do you think that we need some sort of statewide standard to deal with this issue? Do you want to see what Beth Israel has done in terms of just not doing them anymore, spread across the state?
Yes, I think that we recognize in Massachusetts, at least, that there's a need for a coming together of care providers and regulatory agencies in order to bring about safer care with regard to this. And the Massachusetts Perinatal Quality Collaborative, as you pointed out, is meeting today. It's where I just came from. And that's a group of caregivers and the Department of Public Health all coming together to really try to develop a patient education system and develop some benchmarks for all the hospitals and also some resources for care providers so that we can continue to reach our goal.
And Jennifer Block, just in the last couple seconds, I was really moved by what you said about this is medical solutions to social problems. It doesn't seem that the social problems will be solved anytime soon, but at least what you're hearing from people like Dr. Golan, does that give you cause to hope that maybe that there's some progress on the horizon?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this initiative is great. I just hope that this doesn't give us license to induce all labors after 39 weeks. I think the focus should really be on supporting physiological childbirth, which we know is optimal for both mother and baby.
Jennifer Block is author of Pushed, The Painful Truth About Childbirth and Modern Maternity Care. She joined us today from Tucson, Arizona. Jennifer Block, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Tony Golan is an obstetrician gynecologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, let us know what you think, listeners, as always, at radioboston.org. And coming up, singer Patti Larkin remembers the man who taught her what a perfect folk song sounds like. His name is Bill Morrissey. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.